changing people's names, so you lose your identity, to moving people away from families. He did brainwashing with the song, the singing, and we had to chant his name. He had different names. I felt trapped. I didn't know how to get out. One that I got all the time was, I am the wife of Christ. So I have to write that 33 times a day.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in the Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, I'm speaking with Isabella Young. Now, Isabella is another person we're going to talk to about the world of cults, and was part of a cult that was kind of in the ashram yogi master type world, you know, when it comes to meditation and all that kind of thing. We're going to talk about how she left her home country and followed a particular master, if you will, that wound up becoming her husband. And we're going to talk about just the mind control that he had over her and all of his other followers. We're going to talk about just the terrible things that happened within this cult. We're going to talk about the really awful things that happened to Isabella and her children that she had before she joined this group that her husband was the leader of. It's a tough story, but Isabella is an amazing person who does a really awesome job speaking about it. It's heartbreaking, some of the things that happen in this story, and it leads to a few people losing their lives. So I commend Isabella for agreeing to join me and share that story. I commend her for her strength to be able to share it when so many bad things have happened. And I commend her for just the amazing things she's doing now. She's written a book. I think another book is in the works. It's all about just kind of, and that's the area that really enjoyed hearing her story. And I enjoyed hearing about her books. Her books, I think, are things that, have a certain theories that you either subscribe to or you don't. I did find it extremely interesting for sure. So I urge you to listen to that part with an open mind too, kind of just about the world and the state of the world. I think that there's nuggets of wisdom to gain from even things that you're unsure about. So Isabella was an amazing person to speak with, and I think you're really going to find this one impactful. I think you're going to find this one really powerful because she shares a lot, and I'm really, really happy that she agreed to join me. So the links will be in the show notes of how to follow along with her and to check out the book. Of course, with us, go follow along on Apple and on Spotify, subscribe, leave that 5-star review, leave the written review. It helps a lot. Go follow along on Instagram and TikTok, Not Enough Podcast. But let's just get right to the interview. Here is Isabella Young. Bella, how are you?
I'm looking forward to our conversation today, Jackson.
I'm excited too, for sure. And I'm going to let you do the heavy lifting right out the gate. Just introduce yourself, and then we're going to kind of break down who Bella Young is.
My name's Isabella Young, and that actually isn't my birth name. I've changed my name a few times along my journey, and I started off life in Australia. I was born in a little country town in Australia, and life took me to the United States, where I lived in Southern California for a while in a cult. And then once I escaped the cult, I came to the beautiful island of Kauai, where I've been living for the last 16 years and trying to heal from my trauma and past experience and try to understand what happened and learn from there. And I've been writing books and now doing podcasts to share some of the information that I've learned from my experiences.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I want to, like I said, I want to break down all of that, but I kind of want to start with what you just said about how that's not your original name. You, because I've talked to other people from cults in the past. I don't know whether it has anything to do with that and kind of moving on from that world, but I actually talked to somebody who had changed their name 6 different times. The name of their book was actually, I think it was like, man, I'm going to forget. I think it was called A Girl Called Mushroom, but she had changed her name so many different times. And then, that final time, because it was the cult leader that continued to make her change her name. But that final time was kind of just a spring that she was finally able to pick her name. I don't know whether it had anything to do with that kind of thing with you, but what made you decide, I guess, to go by something totally different?
Yeah, that's exactly how it happened. The cult leader who was I was actually married to, he was giving everyone new names. Well, if you deserved a new name or whatever. And so he gave me a new name, which I changed completely, illegally, passports, the whole thing. And then it just felt uncomfortable, that name. I didn't really like it. And so once I got out of the cult, I didn't want to go back to my old name because I had a whole lot of stuff with it too. So I got to choose my name as well. And I chose my first name because it's in my father's lineage. It goes back to like the 16th century. My grandmother did a family tree and the name Isabella was back from the 1600s. So I thought, oh, that's really powerful, like bringing in the father's side of the family. And also my grandmother's name was Isabel. So I liked that name. And then Young was actually my first husband who passed away. And at the time I was like a young into independence and didn't really want to change my name. But I thought, you know what? I really want to honor him, honor his life and honor our relationship. So I chose his last name and I really like my name now.
Oh, I love that. And I think that, you know, a lot goes into a name, certainly when you're able to pick it. So I like that a lot. And I want to kind of go back to even before, you know, we've already talked about how we're going to talk a lot about, you know, a cult that you're in, but I want to talk before that, because I believe that your upbringing was kind of the opposite of that. I believe you grew up in a household that was not at all religious. Is that correct?
My mother was a militant atheist. She hated God and she thought anyone who believed in God or it had anything to do with the religion was like a subhuman, like a complete imbecile. And so I grew up with this like superior attitude to anyone who talked about God or religion. Somehow I felt that, you know, they were less than me. You know, we knew better. I suppose that was what she instilled in me. And she was a real God hater. And even just to say the word, I spent the first 20 years of my life, I just spit the word out with as much venom as I could. It was very damaging, actually, to have that experience growing up. And even though when she would be driving the car, she'd always called out to God and Jesus, she's still outwardly rejected all religions, said it was religions were a crutch for humanity. And so it took me a while to make peace with my knowing of a higher power and even what word to use. You know, I've had different iterations of how I describe that higher power. And actually now I just say God. And I know that's triggering for some people, but for me personally, it's been really important to revisit that word and be able to speak it with love and respect. And so that's how I started my life. Yeah.
Which is certainly, I think there could be a lot to be said there, but I think we've got to kind of move into just that next phase, because, you know, it didn't necessarily get any easier, any less triggering, any less damaging because of the next type of things that happened to you. You talked about a first husband. So I assume that this, you know, this wasn't your first husband. This was a later husband, but you began to, I guess, I don't know your timeline. So I know that you were in a call and it was your husband at the time's, you know, group. So how did that all happen? Rather than me try to surmise it, you tell us how that happened.
I was doing a degree in physical education, and as part of that degree included a semester in outdoor education. So, you know, we did climbing, rock climbing and skiing and hiking. And I met one of the instructors on the rock climbing course. And we had I've never had an encounter like that with another person where the whole energy between us was, I'll just say electrical, but that doesn't really explain it. But it was a really phenomenal experience. And we ended up together. And he was an extremely wise man. And he was actually, I found out just recently, this is how humble he is. I mean, we're talking 30 years ago now, but I found out he was actually the longest serving Australian soldier in the Vietnam War. He did four tours. He was extremely humble and wise. He was a warrior and a spiritual warrior. And he gave me books to read that really opened my mind to there being more to life than what could be perceived through the five senses. And we did meditation courses together, and we did some other like tantra workshops, and you know, we really meditated together. You know, we did a lot of spiritual work together, and he really basically like, I suppose, opened me to the spiritual world. And we'd been together about 7 years, and I was 3 months pregnant with our second child, and he went off to work one day. He was one of the first people in Australia to bring in the using outdoor adventure activities into the corporate world to for companies to team build and, you know, for personal development and that kind of thing. So he was working in that field, and I was doing the same thing in the mental health field. So I was working with young people who had a psychiatric diagnosis, and we were taking them out into the wilderness for, you know, increased self-esteem and stuff like that. So we had a lot of, like, our careers were really quite parallel. It was very beautiful because we'd work with each other. Anyway, he started a company, and it was his first day on the, it was a massive, like, he had 600 people coming from the telecommunications company to do this team building day. And at 10 o'clock in the morning, I got a knock on the door from the, there was a local cop there and my neighbor, and they told me that he'd been found dead in his car. And that was the end of my dream. We were living on a farm, working towards, you know, I wanted to be as self-sufficient as possible with chickens and fruit trees and vegetable garden and all that. And then I that dream just blew up right then and there, and there I was living my nightmare as a single parent. I had to leave the farm because I just couldn't keep it up by myself. We had to chop wood for, you know, firewood and all that, and it was just way too much with the kids. So I went on a long journey to try and find peace, because I really just wanted to die after that happened, but I couldn't because I had two kids. I was pregnant, and that wouldn't have been the right thing to do. So I basically floundered around for years. And then I did this it was a shamanic retreat called Dying to Live, which was a week-long course where we were sensory deprived. So we were blindfolded and in silence most of the time, except when we all met in this, in a room. And we were preparing for our death. So writing our will, writing a eulogy, writing letters of forgiveness and whatever, you know, just in preparation for our death, which was on the last morning. And that was basically a guided meditation. And I had a massive out-of-body experience that, and in that experience, I heard to start training with this particular teacher. I'll just say his name. I'll just say teacher with air quotes, because he turned out to be quite an evil character in the whole thing. And he's still running his cult. His name's Louis Dordonpre. And after I finished the course, called him up, and he said to meet him in New Zealand. He was having a millennium event. So this is back in 2000. So I went to New Zealand, and then he invited me to come to his ashram in California. And my understanding was that I'd met my guru, because I traveled a lot to India, you know, in my quest for understanding and inner peace. So I understood the, you know, how a guru could guide a disciple and see things that the individual couldn't see. So I really actually wanted a guru. That was the truth of it. I was looking for some guidance. But it turned out that I would actually discovered after years that it wasn't an ashram with a guru at all. It was a cult with a cult leader. And I was in that hell for a number of years, about 8 years.
So when did, I guess, it turn into something that, you know, because you said that you had married this person as well. So was it something that, you know, because a lot of cult leaders, that's one of the first things I feel like the cult leaders do, is they start, you know, taking up a lot of different, you know, romantic partners. So was it a monogamous relationship that you were married to this guy, or was it just part of the cult that kind of everybody was married to him, so to speak?
It's so funny, that question. Well, it was monogamous for me, but it turned out it was not monogamous for him. We had sex one time to consummate the marriage, and I got pregnant, and then I gave birth to our daughter. And he never touched me again after I got pregnant. So after I you know, I was 3 months, told him I was pregnant, he never touched me in any like intimate way again. It was so, I mean, that's just, it's another type of sexual abuse. It's not really talked about, but it was excruciating, because, you know, not to be touched or like appreciated, or, and he would always give me excuses like I was too needy, or I was too much like a man. I'd been disrespectful I didn't deserve his touch or whatever. And then the one he just ran for years was that it was for my highest good as a spiritual aspirant to be celibate, which you've probably heard about before. You know, it is some, there are some actual whole cults based on celibacy, but you know underneath that creates some serious problems. And it created serious problems. So while I thought that I was in a monogamous relationship, and this is what I found out later, he was actually grooming the boys, including my son and other young boys in the cult, and he was having sexual relationships with most of the men in the cult. He would say to them, let's explore your sexuality, and then goes on from there, or let's have a massage or a foot massage. And that would lead to just, he had an continuous sexual partners. He's got a sex addiction. He still has, he's still now on Tinder or Grindr or whatever, hooking up. Just the front door's a revolving door of men. Because it turned out that he was living a gay lifestyle when I met him. And then when we got married, he said, oh no, he's healed all his issues, apparently, and he was going to be not living that lifestyle anymore. But he never stopped. He never stopped living an extremely promiscuous gay lifestyle. So in addition to the cult members, he also was just with randoms. And I just found out this, it took years to unfold really what was going on in the cult.
Yeah, and I want to ask you too about just, because in your bio, you talk about it being a, I don't even know if I'm going to say the word correctly, but a messianic cult. What does that mean? What does that mean to the, because that's one that, that's not a word that anyone's used when they've talked about cults on this podcast before.
Okay, so the word's messianic. It comes from the word Messiah. Mm-hmm. And he believes he's the second coming. Mm-hmm. The Maitreya Buddha, the Kalki Avatar, the one who's, he's the second coming. He's come to save humanity. So that's why it's called a messianic cult. He's not the only one. There are lots of them. They're seriously deluded individuals. And he's on his mission to save humanity, and he's got disciples around him, of which I was one at one point, and we were all there to help him on his mission, just like Jesus had disciples around him. And so that's where that word messianic comes from.
Yeah. We've certainly heard on here before about people who think they're the second coming. It's just that I guess we haven't used that word before. So I appreciate you explaining that. I want to hear just a little bit more about exactly what the cult, at least while you were in it, consisted of. Like, how many members were there? Where were you guys located? Was it one that everybody was kind of together on a compound? Did he have, offshoots? Talk about kind of the actual makeup of the group.
Back in the day, when I can talk about it, was what it was like back in the day. I don't know what it's like now. I don't have any contact with anyone who's in it. But back in the day, I think it's still like this, but just a much scaled down version. We had group homes. So our home was the main home, because that's where the guru lives. And the disciples come along to the home. They take it in turns every day to come and cook and clean and do yard work and whatever has to be done, and help with the ministry and with the belief that they're serving Gurujis, their guru, and that helps them evolve spiritually. But basically they're just free slave labor. He's had slaves working for him for over 20 years now. And those people would live in other group homes in the area, so they would have their own house meetings and their own, house politics. There's so much of our time was, all our time was taken up with cult stuff. So, we have meetings, it's called Darshan, that's supposed to be sight of a holy person. We'd have that on Sundays, and then Saturdays was like cleaning day, where everyone would come and clean our house with like toothbrushes on the baseboards type of thing. It was crazy. And heaps of other programs, satsangs and devotional singing. Everyone had to sing to him, which were basically just some traditional Indian bhajans, they're called, devotional songs, and he just had his name. He would just insert his name in them. So we get together to do those sorts of things, and as well as celebrating birthdays and Guru Purnima, it's called. That's the full moon in August. It's devoted to the guru. And then there was his birthday. He decided that his birthday was going to be a 3-day celebration. So we would all celebrate that. He also had cult ashrams in Australia, in Melbourne and Sydney, Tasmania, and I think New Zealand, where people would give them his home, give their home to him, and then so he would travel and visit them and have events, like events in Melbourne and events in Sydney and things like that. So we were, you know, we were kind of spread out. There was probably, I'd say at the most, maybe like 100 people. Sort of, you know, they have the core group of disciples and then the outer group. Maybe that's even too many. Like he's, the interesting thing about this guy, he's stayed small, like kind of under the wire, but he's been able to manipulate almost the same group of people for 20 years, because to be in his presence, everyone needs to tithe 10% of their gross income. So that's what you, you know, what you earn, what you're gifted, what if you sell your house or you get inheritance or whatever, 10% has to go to him. That funds his life, his debauched, you know, life. And that's how he funds himself, is through the tithing. And yeah, like I said, I don't know how many people are there now. I think it's a dwindling number, but it's the same core group of people. It's interesting because, it, you know, these cult leaders are, you know, they're con men. And usually con men will do a con and then move on to do another con. But the cult leaders just do the con on the same people. It's really powerful. I'm just going to use, like, we didn't talk about music swearing or not, but it's basically just, it's mind fuckery. And he, what he did is like completely out of the cult leader's playbook, you know, from like changing people's names. So you know, you lose your identity, to moving people away from families. You know, I shifted from Australia to America, and then keeping people busy all the time, so there's no time to really think for yourself. And we weren't supposed to be reading other books or listening to any other teachers. And, you know, we had to get up at 4 in the morning to meditate. So, you know, very little sleep. Our diet was controlled. He did, you know, the brainwashing with the song, the singing, and we had to chant his name. He had different names that he said were given to him, and like Pranananda and Bhagavan, whatever, you know, like names like that. So we'd have to do repetition of those names. And he did, he just did a lot of brainwashing and a lot of real, like what he'd do with me was, it's called gaslighting. It's, it comes from this play back in the 30s where the protagonist would turn it's when the gas lights were controlled, you know, the lighting for the houses where you could control the intensity of the light when they used gas instead of electricity. And he would adjust the brightness of the light. And then when his wife would comment on that, he said, what are you talking about? You know, like, and so those tactics make an individual doubt themselves. You know, you start questioning yourselves, well, did I say that or was that right? And he did that to me all the time. I can remember that I can track back to the first time when I first came. I was kind of running the house, or that's what I did anyway. That was, you know, that was sort of my thing. And he sent me off to the supermarket. Everything had to be perfect. You know, the fruit's got to be this way, and everything's got to be perfect, and it's got to be this brand and that brand. And he told me to buy this particular brand of toilet paper. And coming from Australia, I didn't know the name. So I made a mental note to remember this name. And when I got home, he said, that's not what I told you to get. Go back and change it. And I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, I remember the first time. And that went on the entire time. You know, he said we had conversations we never had, you know. And then the other thing that he did to really mess with me was he messed with my kids. He punished my son constantly. He handed out punishments for people who were disobedient or disrespectful or hadn't finished their assignments. So an assignment might be he would have all these talks, you know, to share his wisdom, and every word was a jewel. And so every time he opened his mouth, basically it had to be recorded, and then it was assigned to different people to transcribe the recordings into words. So if people hadn't finished that assignment by the set date, then they would be punished. And the punishments included writing lines of affirmation. My one that I got all the time was, I am the wife of Christ. So I have to write that 33 times a day for like 99 days or something like that. You know, he handed out those types of writing lines, I am statements, all the time. And then there was people would be moved houses So that was very disruptive. People had to sleep in garages with no, you know, winter with no padding, or live in their car or pick up dog shit or trash or whatever. So he was constantly handing out punishments. And that, so we lived in an environment that was very demeaning, very unstable and infuriating. And it was hell. It was really hell because he, you know, he was controlling everyone's every, you know, every aspect, who people married, who was having sex with who, and which jobs you could take, what holidays you could go on. It was just straight out of the cult playbook. And, yeah. the thing was, I didn't know I was in a cult. I honestly didn't know I was in a cult, and no one told me. I remember one person who said to me, oh, you know you don't need a guru, don't you? And I said, well, I kind of do, you know, I'm pretty messed up, and because I'd had the death experience in my childhood and all that. So that's the only person I can remember who actually got in my face and questioned what I was doing. And it turns out that my parents, who had divorced when I was pretty young and never did anything together, had gone along to see a cult expert the year after I left Australia. And neither of them ever said anything to me. I don't know what the cult expert said, but from my experience, If I know someone's in a cult, I'm going to tell them, even if it means that relationship ends or drives them. I think it's important to know that you're in a cult. What I would have done if I was my mother, because she had the wherewithal, the time, the money, the resources. I've got five lawyers in my family, you know. That. So what I would have done was to have him get a PI and have him followed, and then, you know, do like a forensic accounting on the bank accounts, and then present that information to me so I can see the photos. I can see what he's doing with the money, how he's siphoning it off and stealing money and hiding money. And at least that would have, hopefully, would have like broken the spell, just like snapped me out of it a little bit, because I was deep into the delusion, and I was pretty suicidal towards the end there.
So do you feel like if somebody would have gotten to you earlier, you would have been receptive? Because that is, you know, that's different than what a lot of people say. And that's, you know, there's books on cults that say the opposite too, where they say, you know, there's a lot of people that have family that are in cults, but until they are willing to listen and understand, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't want it more than they want it. And, you know, I've talked to people that have been in cults that say, you know, there's still family members that are still in cults, and they're still just waiting for them to finally be receptive to hearing something. And once they are, then they're there and ready to explain it. But it's all about whether people are actually receptive to hear. And actually, sometimes it's damaging to try to, you know, argue with them about it until they're ready to hear. So what do you say to that?
From my experience, say something. And like I said, even if that means the relationship ends, and that's what people are afraid of. They want to keep communication anyway. And that's kind of playing along from my point of view. That's just playing along, playing into the game, you know, and the idea of driving someone further into the cult. Well, that may happen, but I personally would rather risk all that by at least planting the seed, at least, you know, like I was so like seriously fucked in the head that if someone had said to me, especially early on, we joked about being in a cult. We were like in the cult that wasn't a cult. So I probably would have rejected the information, but at least there would have been someone who tried, you know, to make me aware of what was really going on. And I know they could all see it. I know my friends have talked about it since then. And I you know, wonder why they didn't say anything. But yeah, I have heard that idea of not, in fact, most people do advise not saying anything to people, but I just know from my experience, it's important to speak up and speak out, and then back that by information. If you can provide photos, if you can provide bank statements or evidence, you know, and the other thing, if you can provide other people, this is another tactic that people could use. If you can find other cult members who've escaped, and then, you know, have them present their reasons, you know, if one of the guys who left the cult had said, hey, you know, your husband's been, you know, have had a sexual relationship with him for the last whatever years. And I'm sure that would have jolted me out of my mind state. Hopefully. I don't know. It's hard to tell now. It's all just hindsight. But that's what I'd say from my experience. If you know something, say something.
Yeah. No, I understand that for sure. I guess I want to ask you, because I always like to kind of, I guess, personify the people that are in, you know, these groups, because it's easy to be like, well, how can people fall for this? I would never be able to fall for this. And that's a lot of times the people who think they're too smart for a cult are the ones that are prime recruiting, you know, territory for a cult leader, because, you know, a lot of times we see the end of a, you know, these really, really bad cults where, you know, the cult leaders spewing crazy, crazy things. And it's just wild, but it doesn't normally start that way. It normally starts smaller things. And then, you know, they start building up more and more kind of devotion to them until they do start saying some really crazy stuff. So I want you now to kind of tell us a little bit about, you know, this, your ex-husband, I guess, to the average person, you know, before you really were involved, what kind of person was he? I would assume, you know, he didn't come across as a crazy person. He probably came across fairly charming and charismatic. That's normally how cult leaders come across if they're going to get people to follow them.
Yeah, they do. They do come across as charismatic and very opinionated and very sure of themselves. I felt more like it was my path to be in the relationship with him, rather than it being a sort of physical attraction type of, you know, I really like this person type of relationship. So it was really difficult because he would always pull the I'm the guru card. So it wasn't a very equitable relationship at all. I just always had to obey him, which doesn't lead to a very healthy relationship. So that was just me personally. But as in relationship to other people, he was very much a storyteller, basically, like he was also a bush. You know, he exaggerated. So he was like, he was able to draw people into his world very well. And then he was able to use the cult tactics on people to get them glued to him, believing in him, giving money to him. And like what you're saying about, as time goes on, when those individuals are fed by people and adored and actually have their feet kissed, I'm not even like metaphoring here, you know, if you've got people adoring you, showering you with attention, always laughing at your jokes and giving you, cooking your food and presenting it with flowers, and, you know, that really builds a very sick and dangerous persona, so that as time goes on, like you say, they do get more grandiose in their, well, they, I've learned about narcissistic personality disorder, and, you know, they get, become quite unhinged with their claims and their expectations. And I don't know where he's at now with that, but they're, like you say, a lot of cult leaders do, it's because they're constantly fed, like they're given that narcissistic supply, and it unhinges them.
Yeah, and I guess the last question before we get you know, to your point where you left or you escaped the cult. But I want to ask now just a little bit about the actual teachings of the group, and maybe more importantly, you know, the most dangerous teachings or the most dangerous things that happened within in this group.
Well, the most dangerous thing was that he to believe anything that he says, particularly with regard to who he is. And that was, you know, to believe that he's that he has any special powers, or that he's actually a good person. That was the most dangerous thing, to even believe that he's a good person with any type of wisdom. Because he didn't really, now that I've learned, he didn't really teach any higher knowledge. It basically just kept the focus on the fact that his disciples were all pretty like fucked up from childhood, and, you know, we really like had emotional wounds that were keeping us from living a happy life. So we were always focused on our faults and our issues. And that was really dangerous too, because there was that tactic that cult leaders use. You've probably heard it called love bombing. So you get praised, and like I was told, I'm the most beautiful this, and, you know, the best mother and all that. And then that would get switched around to you're a piece of shit, you're a bad mother, a bad wife, a bad person. And it's no wonder your family doesn't want anything to do with you. And that happened for everyone. And that would happen in group settings. So, you know, there was hate bombing and love bombing. And that was all, it was such a toxic environment. So everyone's scared of being focused on, because it was usually once he focused his attention on you, then you get, well, I called it shredded, but you usually got reduced to tears because you just feel so bad about yourself. you know, like a bird had fly into the window, and everyone was supposed to analyze why did the bird fly into the window? What does that show me about myself? And usually that means, you know, because I'm not seeing or whatever, you know, he made everyone come up with reasons as to why we were so broken. And I think that though that keeps people very disempowered and in a state of, that's fear-based mind control, keep people in trauma all the time. So that was really dangerous, just that the environment of being, having the someone with the power, someone who's the arbitrator of truth, someone who tells you what to do, and then other people, you know, down here who are all the slaves, basically. I think that was what the most dangerous things about being in that cult.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So let's get to the part where you did leave. And normally, you know, when I talk to people, it's one of two things. It's that, you know, for years they realize this is weird, this is bad, but I'm stuck. I can't get out of it. And then they finally find their way. And then there's also the people who just one day something clicks and it happens. So was it, what was your journey like? Was it something that you knew for a while that you had to move on, or was there an aha moment?
Oh, it was horrible. It's absolutely horrible what happened. Well, he had me trapped because we had a child together. And so I wasn't really able to leave, like legally. I was only moved within 2 hours or something of the place. And so he had me, and he said I couldn't take my daughter. And so I know people do run, but anyway, I'm brainwashed at this point. So he's got me trapped like that way, but he also had me trapped spiritually in a way, because he would continually remind me that I'm his guru, and you know, it's been thousands of lifetimes, tens of thousands of lifetimes for us to come together. And now this was my opportunity to achieve what I wanted to achieve, you know, in terms of being free, being enlightened or whatever it is. You know, I was in that mindset. I've changed a lot since that time. But that, you know, he was promising those types of like end results of my spiritual path. So I felt trapped. And I didn't know how to get out. And then one day my son came home from school, and he was really upset about something. So he didn't want to talk about it. And I said, "Oh, why don't you go to bed? We'll talk about it in the morning." And in the morning he was gone. And he was gone all day. And that was a bit of a worry, because he was supposed to be going on a ski trip. So at the end of the day, we reported him missing to the police. And then the next day, the cult leader sent his assistant to take a walk around the back area of the house. It was one of those stretches where the big telephone poles or the power towers, you know, they leave a strip through neighborhoods there, through those big towers. And he went for a walk up there, and he found my son. He was dead. He had a knife wound to the neck, and the cult leader told everyone that he committed suicide because he found out he was gay, and that he couldn't live with that fact, and he knew that I couldn't live with that fact, so he took himself out, which was just heinous lies. The whole thing was, I found out later, you know, that my son was actually murdered to stop him speaking out about this cult leader being a pedophile, a groomer, a rapist. And that's the experience that broke me out of my cult programming. But it wasn't straight away, though. It wasn't straight away. Like, I was just in so much trauma from that. Like, for 6 months, I just went from breath to breath. I wanted to die again. That was probably worse than the first death that I experienced. But once again, I had children and didn't really want to inflict any more pain and suffering on them. You know, I had to stay around and like at least show up for life. So I went along to see this guy who'd been the cult psychologist. So in addition to having to listen to the cult leader yabber on all the time, we had to go to one was a kinesiologist who'd help us work through our issues, and the other one was a psychologist. And I never went to see him. I was a very disobedient disciple. That was another thing that the cult leader said, that my son had killed himself because I hadn't given him the life that he wanted. I was disobedient and hadn't, you know, I hadn't fulfilled my purpose. And so my son had taken himself out. So I went to see this psychologist, and I walked in the door, and he said, "I knew you'd come and see me. And you know you're in a cult." don't you? And I said, no, I didn't know I was in a cult. I thought I was in an ashram with my guru. And he said, go home and Google cult characteristics. So I went home and I Googled cult characteristics. And then sure enough, charismatic leader, the arbitrator of truth, you know, uses love bombing and controls everyone's everything and check, 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 check. And I thought, oh, fuck, I'm in a cult. And you were right about, like, when you said about how when people enter a cult, it's nothing to do with intelligence, because I know I'm an intelligent person, but I was wounded. I was deeply emotionally wounded. And that creates the opportunity for these cult leaders, because they are opportunists. And that created the opportunity for him to go in and start really messing with me and controlling me and really damaging me. So it still took a while after that to get my shit together. And I think he actually, now that I look back on it, I think he actually let me go, because he still wasn't going to let me go. He did the same, like, you know, you can't leave, this is your destiny. And you can't take your daughter. He did that on me. But I think that he knew that he would have another death on his hands if he made me stay there, because I didn't want to be there. I didn't even want to be alive. So he let me go without any resistance. And that's when I moved to Hawaii and started to heal, started to learn about what it was in me that made me vulnerable to cult programming, and just to start healing my broken heart. And it's been a long journey and it's still continuing, but I've definitely come a long way. Like, I don't suffer now. I used to suffer all the time. All that was my constant experience. But now it's not that I don't feel, you know, those more intense, dark emotions, but I'm able to enjoy life. And I am, I've really freed myself from cult programming, and the journey continues. But it was my son's death that was the murder, my son's murder that broke me free from the cult programming.
So did anything come of that? I mean, were they able to hide it well enough that nobody really got in any kind of trouble for this death?
He spun it so perfectly that he, like, totally just did the suicide thing and the reasons why, that, you know, he's talked to the cops and they believed all these stories. The cops didn't even interview the last people to see my son. He just spun it all. Like, he's a spin doctor. So he had the body cremated within about 3 days. So there was no way to, like, do any forensic testing or whatever. And honestly, I was so fucked up. I couldn't even contemplate. I didn't even think he'd have been murdered. Let's, you know, investigate it again. I was just basically trying to survive, even though a lot of people in the community were very skeptical about what had happened. I wasn't online at the time, but there was a large group of people on, it was, anyway, they were on like a Reddit forum or whatever, and they were all commenting. Now I look back on it, I can see people were very skeptical and suspicious and didn't believe the stories that were told. And then by the time I kind of got my act together in a way to, I didn't even read his autopsy until like last year. It was just so traumatic. I couldn't even do it. And then I read the autopsy. I'm like, fuck, this is, there were things that were wrong in it about my son. So it's now I'm at the point where I'm not going to waste any more of my time or energy going down that route. I've called the police or the detectives who are in charge of the case, and it's getting too long now. Like, even the witnesses, they're older and they don't feel like they can trust their judgment anymore. So in terms of any consequences for my son's murder, I'm not pursuing that. I just don't want to put any more of my time, energy. I don't have the money to fight him legally, and he suffers every day. You know, he lives in hell already. There's nothing that I really need to do to get any justice or anything like that. I feel it's already playing out that way. I mean, he has to get up every day and lie to people. He is, you know, someone with a narcissistic personality disorder has created a false persona that then they have to work at, you know, and they have to keep their storylines going. And, you know, that goes on with everyone. It must be hell. Must be a lot of work and not fun at all. And then they've got all their addictions and their demons and everything like that. So, you know, he's suffering. Not that I take glee in that, but I just know that he is. And I'm not going to pursue the legal route.
Yeah, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of clarify one issue. I think I understand what you're saying, but there's been a few times. So in the beginning, we talked about, you know, how he was living, you know, a homosexual lifestyle. And you mentioned how, you know, he was messed up. He was living a homosexual lifestyle. And then we talked about how he spun it that your son had, you know, killed himself because, you know, he had found out that he was gay and that, you know, that he wouldn't like it and that you wouldn't like it. I guess I want to allow you to clarify. I assume you're not saying that particular thing was an issue. It was that he was spinning it and that he was doing these things while you were married, which is not good. Correct?
Yeah, I don't have an issue. I wouldn't have had an issue if my son was gay. That's not an issue for me. None of that. But it's typical narcissistic behavior to project. Right. So they tell you what they're doing. If they criticize you of having affairs, they're having affairs. If they say that they're uncomfortable with being gay or that's an issue, that's because they have an issue with it. You know, that's his case. You know, he's the one with an issue with it. But I just want to add in this bit is how I found out about this was in the cult in Melbourne. The cult leader there, she's a extremely evil woman. She adopted her two nephews who were very traumatized by their upbringing. The parents died young, and so she adopted them when they were about 7 and 8. And from that, pretty much about age 10 or 11, those boys were told that they were gay. And every time they denied it, they were punished. And they were told that if they didn't accept the fact that they were gay, that they would continue to suffer. And all they needed to do was admit they were gay and all their problems would go away. And she actually sent these boys to him. So when they would have a retreat, she would send the boys to his bedroom. And I found out speaking with the young men now, but they were seriously traumatized. These boys are really, really traumatized by their cult experience, and neither of them are gay. And they both of them were really damaged by that experience. And I was grateful that they did find the courage to speak up and let me know what was really going on behind closed doors, because that's how I put pieces together to understand what was happening with my son.
That's baffling for sure. I don't have words to say about that, because that's terrible. But I guess it does kind of make me wonder what happened with, you know, because I know we already talked about your son, but you had other children and you left the cult. What happened with your other children?
I didn't mention this bit, that this is one of the, what's called a PSYOP, a psychological operation, right? It happens on the grand scale and with humanity, but it also happens in cults too. So this is going to sound really kooky, but this is how it went down. So he's announced himself as the Maitreya, the Kalki avatar, and also Lord Shiva. If you know anything about in the Hindu pantheon, Lord Shiva is he's the creator god, one of the creator gods. So he's Lord Shiva, and that means that I'm then his divine counterpart, and that Lord Shiva and Shakti have a child called Lord Ganesha, and that deity is the remover of obstacles. So when I was pregnant, he told me that I was going to be giving birth to Lord Ganesha, who was the remover of obstacles and was going to remove all the obstacles that were in the way of me being an obedient disciple, and also serve humanity in that way. So when she was born, she was venerated, and she spent the first few years of her life being treated differently from the other children, which is also extremely problematic for me too. That, and I know he did that another one on purpose just to infuriate me. And she was sat in chair. He had in the lounge room, there was his seat, just, you know, like I suppose you could call it a throne or whatever, but it's got flowers at the bottom where he put his feet and all that. So she was the only one who was allowed to sit in his chair beside him. And she would also be brought up on stage with him. And then I put a stop to that after a few years. That was just batshit crazy. And that's ended up being very problematic, because what he did with my children was, it's a classic narcissist tactic, is called triangulation. So you peg people against each other within the family structure. So he had like me against my children and the children against each other. And so he brainwashed my daughters against me, basically told them every day I was a crazy idiot and a bad parent, bad mother. And he would tell them that I loved each one of them differently, you know, that so-and-so was my fate. And that was, I could never understand that because it's never how I felt. I didn't have a favorite child. I know people talk about that, but in my heart, I loved them all equally. But he played them like that. And that's created an ongoing fracture in our relationships. And the truth of it is that in a family with a narcissistic parent, either one or two narcissistic parents, because this is what I learned about narcissistic personality disorder. After I realized that he had a narcissistic personality disorder, it's all well and good to like start pointing the finger at all his faults. But what did that mean about me? Like, why was I in a relationship with someone with a narcissistic personality disorder? And I learned that that meant that I have codependent tendencies, which means it's a similar self-love deficit disorder. I'm looking for love outside of myself, but it's a perfect dovetail for someone with a narcissistic personality disorder. And the healing is, the cure for that is to establish self-love. And that took a long time for me to do that. And I learned through the fact that I would be in relationships with other people who had narcissistic personality disorders that I finally just said, enough. I have to love myself, to figure out a way. I have to just get that in place, and then that's the protection from further narcissistic abuse. But the thing is, when there's one parent or two parents with a narcissistic personality disorder, the children will either be codependent or have a narcissistic personality disorder. I can see it in my own family. I was the one with the codependency tendencies, and my two brothers turned out to have narcissistic personality disorders. In my own children, that happened. And unfortunately, as much as I tried, on whatever, both of them have narcissistic personality disorders. I thought that my love was powerful enough to spare them and save them, but it wasn't. They were from a very young age brainwashed against me.
So are they still part of this group, or are they just estranged and doing something else?
I don't know. I know definitely one daughter's not part of the group. She lives in Australia, and the other one, I don't know. I don't know what she's doing.
Good. So I want to, it's been, I think you said 15 or 16 years since you've moved to Hawaii. You know, you were able to escape the cult, and you were able to start that journey in healing. So I want to ask you, what's been the most challenging part of all of it? And I ask that, you know, knowing that, you know, I've talked to people who left the cult that they were in 1978, and still every day, that cult leader is in the back of their head, and they're still trying to overcome those things. So I know that it's, you know, it's a long process. It's honestly is, you know, it's a lifelong process. So talk a little bit about, I guess the biggest challenges that you face now that, you know, you've been able to escape, but you still have to deal with some of the trauma from all of it.
Oh, the guilt. Just the guilt that I got into the cult and my son died, you know, he lost his life because of my choices. That's very hard. Still working on that one. And the shame, you know, that how I feel so ashamed that I believe this really dangerous person. I trusted him. And then that set me up for doubting myself. Like, how am I ever going to trust myself again? Because I really felt like I was you know, following my intuition or guidance or whatever. And I was, but it led me into this hell. So how would I ever trust myself again? That's been a journey to trust myself again. So it's the feelings of like self-hatred and yeah, that they've been the hardest things to deal with. I don't really hear him in my head anymore. He's quite an insignificant character now in my life, because what I decided once I left was that I'd already given like 8 years of my life and, you know, my womb and I'd given myself to him, and I wasn't going to waste any more time thinking about him, talking about him. And I really didn't. And it's only been in recent years when I've started doing podcasts that I've actually been contacted by other people who left the cult So then we get to talking about him, but he's very much a distant memory. But what I was really left with was repairing my relationship with God, you know, because what the cult leader does is that, or any religious leader, they become an intermediary between an individual and the higher power. You know, they're the broker. So I needed to just establish a direct connection and repair that relationship, and then work on self-forgiveness and coming to peace with myself, and like I mentioned, establishing self-love. That was the most difficult thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the great thing is, I think that it's, you know, we've spent the last, 50 minutes talking about what happened and why it happened and how a lot of people, you know, got sucked into this, and a lot of people are still sucked into it. So I think that you, sounds like you have all the tools. You just have to listen to yourself as far as when it comes to the, you know, the doubting how you got involved and the guilt with all of it is, I mean, it's a thing that happens to a lot of people. And I think you've realized that too. It's just a matter of trusting yourself and listening to yourself. So I'm glad to hear that you have those tools. And I think that hopefully, you know, it never gets easier, but I think it just gets a little bit, the blunt of it all gets a little bit better anyway. So that's what I hope. That's what I hope for you, for sure. And you're doing some great work outside of this. It's led you to some great things. So I want you to talk about the book that you have and just the work that you're doing to help others, you know, understand, you know, your story and understand when they're getting themselves into something that's, you know, could be very detrimental.
Well, what I love most about what I'm doing now is, I'm writing about all the different practices and tools and medicines that I used to heal from the trauma, the heartbreak, and the mindfuckery that went on. And so what I've discovered is that by connecting and spending time in nature has been the balm for my heart, you know, medicine for my soul. And so I've been, I haven't worn shoes for about 8 years. That's called a practice called grounding or earthing. So I'm directly connected to the earth and receiving the energy from the earth. So that's very invigorating and helps me balance from all the chaotic EMFs and I receive like negative ions, and it's a very powerful practice. And the other one that I practice that I do every day is called sun gazing. So as the sun comes up, I watch it lift above the horizon and receive the sunlight directly into my eyes, which is just extraordinary practice. It's so easy, and it doesn't have to take that long. Start off with just a few seconds and build up from there. And that light, I don't know exactly how it works, but it's the most, it's the highest form of energy and information, because light is information that we can receive. So to take it straight into the eyes, into the brain is like, it just changes, it optimizes everything, you know, this like light optimizes life. So I do that practice. It can also be done at dusk and, I mean, at sunset. So I've been connecting, spending a lot of time in the water, learning how to relax and just receive the energy from nature. And that's really what's helped me. That's what's, you know, like sourced me. So it continues to source me. So I've been writing about all the different types of medicines that we have within our bodies. You know, we can use our breath to change how we feel. We can use our just physical movement. We can use our voice. You know, if you're singing, then your vibration increases. If you're moving, your energy increases. If you're, you can change your breathing to change how you feel. That's a really important practice, to be able to breathe properly, you know, deep full belly breathing. And there's a lot more body technologies. Then there's all the medicines in nature, like I've said, grounding and sun gazing and eating high vibrational foods. Like I sprout my own sprouts, which anyone can do, and that's, you're receiving the life force energy from the sprouts, and also eating the freshest possible organic fruits and vegetables. That helps to heal our bodies and optimize the way our bodies function. And then in addition to that is the sorts of spiritual technologies that are available, like meditation and prayer and chanting and pilgrimages and all, you know, there's a lot of tools and technologies and medicines that are available to us that are free and easy to use and safe and effective that are being forgotten, especially as now that most people are relating to life through a screen. Like, that's very unnatural and very disempowering for a human being. We're really not meant to be doing that. It's very disadvantageous for us. So to remind others that the natural world is really where we're meant to be, you know, rather than taking a cue from a slave device, I call them, you know, to take the cues from like what you're feeling in your body. What's your body telling you? Is it, does it need food? Does it need water? Does it need rest? Should you go that way or that way? You know, there we get our, you know, it's our intuition. So listening to intuition. And then I'm writing. It's basically like a reminder of how to be a human being, because that information is being forgotten, or it's being treated as just like hippie woo-woo shit. But it's actually some of the most effective and powerful medicines are the most simple. And so I wrote a book a couple of years ago. It's called Putting on the Armor of God, which is about all the ways that we can empower ourselves. And the one that I'm doing now is an even larger expansion of that. It's actually about 700 pages long. I'm probably going to have to divide it into a few books, but I think it's got a lot of beneficial information there for anyone who's interested in overcoming traumas, healing, expanding consciousness, and just life as a good, kind, authentic human being.
Yeah, and you said something I hadn't heard in a long time. You talked about sprouts. I had someone on like 2 years ago who, you know, talked all about that. They even sent me like a sprout kit and the mung beans and everything. So I hadn't heard about that for a while. I need to dig that back out. I kind of forgot about the world of sprouts, but we've heard about the benefits of that in the past. I want to clarify two things that you mentioned just for people driving in their car and thinking, whoa, what was that? So you said about the grounding, which, you know, I've heard of before. You said, you said you hadn't worn shoes in 8 years. Do you like at all? Do you go into stores without wearing shoes?
Sometimes. I mean, I'm going to wear them if I'm traveling and going on a plane, or I'm walking down a hot road or a spiky road, but just generally, even when I go to work, my boss doesn't make me wear shoes. So most of the time I don't wear shoes. And there's a documentary called Earthing, and it's on YouTube, and it's really, everyone should watch that. That should be like, you know, it played in everywhere, because that gives you a scientific explanation of why it's important for us to be connected to the earth. We have animal bodies. You know, we are basically an animal. And our ancestors didn't wear shoes, not because they didn't have a fashion sense, but because they knew it was important to be connected to the earth. So if they protected their feet, it was like with leather, which is conductive, you know, or shoes made of plant material. So they were still in touch with the earth. They understood. This is why we're so sick as a society. Because we've been disempowered, because we've been disconnected from nature. You know, most people spend so much time indoors now, like not even going outside, not even breathing fresh air or receiving sunlight. We've been poisoned against the sun. You know, there's all this sun protection and all that. The sun's the giver of life. And okay, don't go and fry yourself. That's not the point, but it's really, we really need, our bodies need to receive sunlight. It, you know, the cells, when light enters the body, it goes down, you know, it goes right through down into the cells, and it stimulates the production of ATP, of cellular energy. And then that, the cascade that goes on from there is essential for optimal health. We can't expect to be optimally healthy, mentally or physically, without a direct connection to earth. So that can be done, the grounding can happen by walking barefoot on the earth. Wet grass is great. The beach is optimal. If you can walk along the beach, that's just because that's probably the best thing to do. But you can also, you can lie on the earth. You can walk on bricks and concrete because they're conductive. And you can touch trees. That whole like making tree hugging like a hippy dippy thing is you receive the energies from the trees, and they've got their roots into the ground. So, you know, you can touch a tree when you go past it, touch a plant. If you pet And an animal that's been outside, it's grounded. So you'll be grounded if you like pet your cat or your dog. And then by hugging another person who's grounded. So, and then there are crystals and rocks, and there are other like features in nature that can ground us and keep us connected to the earth, which is it's essential. It's fundamental.
Yeah.
You know,
And
we that health. I was going to say health starts from the ground up, literally.
well, yeah. So another thing of clarification, you mentioned with the looking at the sun. I think hopefully the big parts were that at sunrise and sunset, you're not telling people at midday to go stare at the sun. I don't think that's a good thing.
No, it just the practice of sun gazing is best started at when the sun's just rising or just setting. That's when it's safe to look at the sun and just look with a soft gaze. You know, you can just have your eyes just slightly open so you're just receiving the light into your eyes. It also you'll receive it through your eyelids and through your skull. You know, we have the bones in our head our body are porous, so the sunlight will still come in, but if you receive it straight into your eyes, that's the most powerful. And then you can build up after like 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, just slowly over time. You can build up the amount of time that you do that, and then you can, well, now I can look at the sun at different positions in the sky, and it's still really, it's extremely powerful and intense practice, but it does take a while to build up to looking at the sun for longer. And the thing is, if there's any pain, just stop. It's not one of those no pain, no gain practices. That's just not it. If there's any pain, just stop it. And then I just usually give thanks for whatever I've received, and it's expanded my consciousness. I've learned so much from receiving sunlight.
I think we went into an area that we could probably spend another hour talking about. So, you've been really generous with your time. I want you to tell people how they're going to find your book, how they're going to find all of your connection points.
I have a YouTube channel that I really love because I put a lot of my nature images on there, because not, we can get benefits from seeing images of nature, because a lot of people looking, most people look at screens now, so appreciating images of nature and also hearing the sounds from nature. That's a way to connect with nature too, if you are indoors. You know, that you bring plants inside, play sounds of waterfalls or waves crashing or birds singing or whales or whatever. You know, that our bodies need those sounds to just relax. Most people live very fast-paced life, busy, 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 you know, just that constant busyness, and body needs to relax every now and again, and nature helps to do that. So for my YouTube channel that I love so much, so I've got a lot of videos on there because I spend a lot of time snorkeling and collecting fishing line and all that and seeing cool stuff. So there's that is a good place to see what I'm up to. And I have a website called feelingbetternaturally.love, and that's a good, I've got my artwork and videos and writings and information about the books that I'm working on. And I have a Substack that's feelingbetternaturally.love, and the book will be available on Amazon. This is the other book that I wrote. It's called Putting on the Armor of God. That's available on Amazon now. It's probably a little bit outdated. Just be better to wait for the next one, which will be out in a couple of months, and that I'll have information about that on my website.
Yeah, I
New
got you.
human of new earth.
New human of new earth. Well, I really, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I'm so grateful for the opportunity, Jackson, and I really appreciated how you've done this interview, your interview style. It's
Absolutely.
been really easy to speak with you. Thank you, and appreciate
Thank you.
you.
So that was Isabella Young. Just a powerful story. One that I just, like I said in the beginning, there's the strength to be able to share it. The things that happened to her, the death of one of her children. It can't be easy to, open up those wounds and continue talking about it, but she does it because she wants to make sure other people don't get trapped in situations like she did. So I just can't thank her enough for joining me and for sharing. I hope that you took some things away from that conversation. And, she does have some different thoughts when it comes to how to approach people that are currently in a cult. You know, we've talked to a lot of people that have you know, escaped cults, and the things that they say are a little different than Isabella. That doesn't necessarily make either side right or wrong. So I'm glad that we had a new perspective. And when it comes to perspective, I hope that you learned a lot when it comes to her perspective in writing her book. That book was called Putting on the Armor of God. Definitely an interesting take on you know, the world as a whole and energies. And, you know, she talked about you know, the sun and the way that it helps too. I learned a lot there as well. So hopefully you did. Hopefully you gained a lot from this week's episode. I will put links in the show notes on how to pick up her book and how to follow along with her, because I know she has some more things in the works. So urge you to check out those things. If this is your first time listening to this podcast, or you haven't already, go follow along on Instagram and on TikTok, Not Enough Podcast, Not Enough with Jackson Enough on Facebook, jacksonenough.com. Go subscribe, follow along on Apple and on Spotify. Leave that 5-star rating, helps a lot. Leave a written review on Apple, helps even more. But we'll see you next week. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think, or hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.